Today, something better than a gift to tear open for Christmas.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
It was as long before Christ's birth that Abraham received the promises from God as it is now since Christ's birth. These are how great the periods of time are that we're talking about. But in order to have a conversation about Christmas and see something about it that I think I think I've heard it before. I think some of us recognize it, but I think a lot of us overlook it every Christmas. For us to look at that, I need to go all the way back in Israel's history to the beginning, to Abraham, in order for us to appreciate what happens on that Christmas day. The story that we love reading in Luke 2, I think Luke uses to make a point that we sort of overlook. And so I want to emphasize that by starting with Abraham and the promise that God gave him from the very beginning about how he would deliver a Messiah to the world through Abraham, and that the entire world would be blessed through him. God's promises to Abraham happen almost 2,000 years before Christ is born, and there is a perpetual frustration of those promises. They never seem to come to reality, to full fruition, with just a couple of very brief exceptions that serve as encouragements or continuity for people to continue to have their faith. And if you go back to the beginning of the story about Abraham, when he's just called Abram in Genesis 12, we know that God sets him apart and the land that he has promised to them in those very opening statements he makes. Now, the Lord said to Abram, "Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed." And there's something built into the way God gives that covenant that makes it about the land that God has promised them. So God says to Abram, you need to leave the land you're currently in and go to the land I'm going to send you to. You are leaving your family behind, and I am going to give you offspring who will bless all the families of the earth. And in all of those promises, we know Abraham believes, he acts obediently, and that's built into the covenant as well. So you're going to receive the land, and when you're obedient to me, I'm going to bless you, and it's not just going to bless you, but all the nations of the earth. This is the sort of covenant that God establishes with Abram. And yet consistently, successively, one generation after another, the promise is not realized. I mean, even the moment Abram arrives in the promised land, he then turns around, gathers up Sarah, and goes to Egypt because there's a drought, and he's worried that he's not going to be able to feed his family or take care of the people who are with him. There is that constant frustration, and we know we're supposed to see it that way because even the author of Hebrews, long after all of this is over, in the New Testament, the author of Hebrews is telling us that Abraham acted in obedience toward a promise that was never realized in his life, that he and all the other saints like him in the Old Testament had acted on a promise that God was going to realize for us in the person of Christ, but that they never experience in this world. That frustration, that thing that evokes in them the prayer, "How long, O Lord, when will this finally be realized?" That frustration is always present in the Old Testament, but so are God's assurances to them that even though they're doing without right now, even though they are not realizing the full benefit of the covenant, not seeing the fruition of it, it will come. and God is still being faithful. And perhaps nothing illustrates that more importantly than what happens several hundred years after Abraham and the people are settling in the land itself. So several hundred years after Abraham, and I mean after his descendants, Jacob, Joseph, have already gone to Egypt, have been there for 400 and more years, 430 years and more, and have come back to the promised land and have settled into it, and Joshua has conquered the land, so to speak, and then the judges begin to rule, we finally have this episode that we're told about in the book of Ruth. And it actually opens by telling us when it's happening during the time of the judges. And I bring it up because this almost 1,000 years later, almost 1,000 years after the promise was made to Abraham that God was going to bless him in this land so that all the nations of the earth would be blessed, the land is still being cursed. There are still famines happening in the land, and people are still so hungry, so desperate that they leave the land that God has promised to them to go somewhere else so that they can be provided for. This is what's happening in the book of Ruth, which is telling us about the famine and about Naomi, Ruth chapter 1. Just a couple of little sections from Ruth 1 will make this point. And this is not to focus just on Ruth today or that story, but just to remember from what happened with Abraham and what happened with Ruth, also what's happening with all the people of Israel and what God does when he builds the temple, when he has Solomon build the tabernacle, and then when Solomon builds the temple and illustrates what they were carrying around with them in the wilderness with Moses in the form of the tabernacle. When that finally happens, that's what we're trying to get to. And so looking at Ruth's story in Ruth chapter 1, it begins with the statement, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And we're such naturalists that when we read that story, and I mean by naturalists, we just don't think of anything supernatural causing things.
Well, we have a scientific explanation. You know, there must have been a La Nina that year.
That's all we think of. We don't pay attention to the fact that God himself said, when you're obedient to me, I'm going to bless the land and I'm going to send the rains and you'll have harvests. And when you're disobedient to me, then I will withhold the rains and the land will dry up and you will not have a harvest, because he wants them to repent and turn to him. He told them that from the beginning. I'm not saying to you every time it rains on your crops or not that God is blessing or cursing you. We are told in the New Testament, in Jesus' own words, that he causes it to rain on the righteous and on the unrighteous. So we're blessed by God all the time. But I am saying there's no way on this earth that a Jew would have read those statements in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and not understood that there was a curse on the land, that something is wrong. God is not blessing the earth the way he promised he would when his people were obedient. And so in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem, Beit Lechem, the house of bread, is the place where the famine is taking place. And yes, this place, this house of bread, every person who's reading this story, which is written after the fact, every person who's reading the story knows now, oh, this is a story about David, because Bethlehem is the house of David. That's where he's from. And so we're going to learn something about him. They know that's what the story is about. So here's a story about the people of God being cursed by God with a famine, and a man who lives in Bethlehem, where God is going to prove his faithfulness to his people by giving them the Old Testament Messiah, the anointed one of Psalm 2, David. You know, this is where he's going to come from. So we already know at the very beginning of the story, if we're thinking of it from the perspective of those who would have read it first, we already know this is going to be about God's testimony of his faithfulness to his people. So it says, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, the name of the wife, Naomi. We know this story, right? So the name of the wife is Naomi, pleasant or blessed. The names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, and so they were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab. So they leave Bethlehem, but they're blessed. I mean, she has a husband, she has two sons, they're going over to this other place, which is going to be able to take care of them, because apparently they have provisions there where they don't in Bethlehem. So they go to the country of Moab, and they remained there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with only her two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, the name of the other, Ruth, and they lived there about 10 years, and apparently they have no children, and then Mahlon and Chilion die. So that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. She is as desolate as she can be in the story. She is, not only has she experienced a famine in the land of God, but when she went to another place so that she could be blessed, she loses all the blessings she had, even in that desolate land of God. The husband and the two sons, they're gone. We know how she returns, and Orpah goes back, but Ruth stays with her and comes to the land. And so the two of them went on. This is at the end of Ruth chapter 1. The two of them went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" And she said, "Don't call me Naomi. I'm not blessed anymore. Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mary. Call me Mara," as it is in Hebrew. And that's the name that's going to be given to people 1,000 years later, when Mary herself is born and Jesus is going to be born to her. Her parents are naming her after a woman who wanted to be called Bitterness because things were so bad. So you can imagine how bad things are in the land of Israel when the Romans are occupying it and the Greek culture is infiltrating it and everything seems corrupt, that people have a child and they say, "Hey, what do you want to name her?" And they say, "Well, I think I'll name her Bitterness." That's a testimony to how difficult things were for them, even 1,000 years after this. And so anyway, Naomi says, "Just call me Mara, because things are not pleasant for me anymore. God, the Almighty, has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. So why call me Naomi?" Now, she went away during a famine, but she comes back and there's a harvest going on. That is, God is now blessing his people in their land. So while she sees herself as being completely barren of any hope, the reality that she's in this land that God has promised them and that God is blessing that land is also a testimony that he is blessing his people with what he promised to Abraham from the beginning, which was not just that their land would have a harvest, but that Abraham himself would have an offspring who would bless all the families of the earth. And that's what he's doing right now with the continuity of providing David through Naomi and Ruth. So as the story goes on, she says, "Oh, I'm coming back empty." But we realize she's actually coming back to a place where God is going to fill her up. And so when the Lord had testified against me and he's brought this calamity upon me, Naomi returned and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of barley harvest. And anybody who reads literature very well knows this is a sign of fertility. God is going to bless them in a way they haven't anticipated yet. And so in the very next chapter, when Ruth says, "Hey, let me go beg in the fields," the way people do when they're so impoverished, they don't have anything of their own that they can rely on. They have to rely on the goodness of God's people to be faithful to the law he gave so that they would provide for the people who were poor around them. "Let me go beg," according to that. And she's not going to go sit at a gate and ask people for things, but she's going to go to a field where she has no right of her own and assume or trust a person to be obedient enough to the law to allow her to glean in that field. There's no enforcement of it. There's just be obedient or don't be obedient. And so she is, maybe somebody will find favor on me. Maybe somebody will allow me to glean in their field. And the way things worked for them is it's not the same as it is for us. I mean, in some places it probably was, but here in this place outside of Bethlehem, there's only so much arable land. There are only so many places where you can have a field. And so they did what a lot of Puritans did in America when they first settled here. And it was sort of a failed experiment in America, but you would just have a large plot of land where everybody's field was. And that was the field for the village. But then you would divide up the plot of land and say, "Well, this part's yours, this part's yours." and you all worked in the same field, but you just knew this row was Smith's and this row was Jones's, for instance, in the Americas. And for them, they had apparently divided this one field up into plots, because that's how Ruth describes it. She says, let me go to the field, and or that's how the author of the book of Ruth describes it. She says to Naomi, hey, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I'll find favor. In other words, maybe there's still hope for us that we don't just starve to death. And she said to her, Naomi says to her, so go, my daughter. And she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And this is specific language in Hebrew. It's not a mistranslation or an idiomatic mistake of English. This is what Hebrew is telling us happened. She set out and went and gleaned in the field after the harpers, and as chance would have it, or she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. From our perspective, that's what happens. I mean, it's just happenstance. It's sort of like the book of Esther. We know the sovereign hand, the providential hand of God is behind all of this. But for her, it's just, yeah, I just happened to land on the part of the field that belongs to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And we all know the rest of the story, how he's the kinsman redeemer and she's going to end up with a child, which the city is then going to celebrate, not as the child of Ruth, but as the child of Naomi, the one who had for now, we're 1,000 years since the promise to Abraham, almost, not quite, but we are close to a millennium since the promise to Abraham and the frustrations to the people of God that have come in drought after drought and failure after failure. And now God is still showing up and saying, well, I haven't quit. Oh, I'm not through at all. I'm faithful. And you'll see that as, and he's testifying this, and the author of Ruth makes this clear at the end of the book, and every reader sees it and is able to celebrate it when they see that out of this union, I mean, Boaz, there's Obed, and then Jesse, and then David is born. And David the king is the testimony that God really is going to provide that seed that's going to be a blessing to all the nations of the earth. But David himself is not it. I mean, shortly after he becomes king, he starts messing up. And he's so bad, in fact, in his lifetime that God won't allow him to build the temple. I'm going to build a temple for God. No, you've got too much bloodshed on your hands. I'm not going to let you do that. Your son can do it. You can start gathering up the things for it. But your son is the one who's going to have to build it. So in the building of that temple, there's actually a message, a symbol of exactly this same thing. The reality that God has made a promise that he's going to fulfill, but there is some enormous barrier between us, that is between Israel, and the realization of that promise that God has made. And it continually testifies to how we are frustrated, but also know that God has not finished making the promise. Where that shows up in the temple is next. And so in the temple, when Solomon actually builds it, there is this description of the holiest place. This one place set apart in the core of the temple where the presence of God itself was signified or represented. And so in the most holy place, and this is described in 2 Chronicles 3, verse 10, and this temple is the sign, right? God is using the temple just like he used the tabernacle in the wilderness as they traveled, and then as they set it up in Canaan in different places when they arrived there. It was the testimony that God was among them, that God lived among his people, and that they were acting in obedience to his commands, and that they could see the evidence of his holiness right in the middle of their camp and so on. Well, when Solomon converts that to a temple, to an established structure, God is saying, so now I've put you in the land where I'm going to bless you. And of course, Solomon is the king that's blessed the most. Now, we remember, though, that Solomon doesn't receive the fullness of the promise either. I mean, even in Solomon's great obedience and great wisdom from God because of his humility and the request that he makes for wisdom and not for long life and wealth for himself, even in all of that wisdom, as soon as he begins reigning, he's marrying one pagan woman after another, and in the attempt to create alliances around the world, and in his own effort to do all of those things, we know how disobedient he becomes, worshiping false gods himself by the end of his life. And as soon as he dies, the kingdom is split in half between Rehoboam and Jeroboam. So they don't experience the fullness of God's blessing even under Solomon's reign. But in Solomon's reign, when he builds this temple, There is an image of that that we have to see. And when I say that, I mean an image of the fact that they know what God has promised. They know how magnificent it is. They know the holiness of God, the truth and faithfulness of God. They know all of that, and yet they just can't quite realize it in this world. It is all, they're always falling short, and most of the time, dramatically short of what he has called them to. And so in Solomon building the temple, there's a description of this one feature in the temple that makes it clear that God wants us to understand this barrier between his holiness and the reality of where we're living in the world. He wants us to understand that he knows that it's there for a good reason, but also that it won't always be there. And so in 2 Chronicles, it's described for us this way in chapter 3, in the most holy place, this is that inner sanctuary representing the presence of God for his people, in the most holy place, he made two cherubim of wood and then overlaid them with gold. And the wings of the cherubim together extended 20 cubits. One wing of the one of 5 cubits touched the wall of the house, and its other wing, again of 5 cubits, touched the wing of the other cherub. And of this cherub, one wing of 5 cubits touched the wall of the house, and the other wing, also of 5 cubits, was joined to the wing of the first cherub. The wings of these cherubim extended 20 cubits. The cherubim stood on their feet facing the nave. So they're facing as if a person could walk through into the Holy of Holies, they would see the cherubim looking at them. It's facing the nave. And he made the veil, this veil that separates them so that you can't see the cherubim. And he made the veil of blue and purple and crimson fabrics. This is a blue veil with crimson and purple fabric woven into it as well. So this veil of blue and purple and crimson fabrics and fine linen, and what's worked onto the veil? He worked cherubim onto the veil, as if embroidered is the way I think we would think of it. I don't know exactly how that's done, but somehow in the working of these threads together to make this enormous veil that separates the Holy of Holies from everything else, he works the cherubim onto it. Not the enormous statues, but some figures of cherubim onto the curtain itself, onto the veil itself. And then, by the way, I find this coincidental and interesting. It is coincidental. I'm not presuming that this is a direct relationship, but you know, with God, coincidences are convenient, right? So in the front of the house, he also made 2 pillars. Have you heard of these 2 pillars? 35 cubits high, a capital of 5 cubits on the top of each. And he made chains like a necklace and put them on the tops of the pillars. And he made 100 pomegranates and put them on the chains. And he set up the pillars in front of the temple on the south and on the north. And the one on the south was called, he gives names to these pillars. Most likely, this is the speculation of historians, most likely they're named after an architect or, you know, 2 architects or 2 donors who helped to fund the temple or something like that. But they get names. You know what the names are? Yakin, meaning something like established. And then on the north, the pillar is called, I just find this interesting, Boaz. That's the name of the pillar on the north, which is fascinating. So in his strength or something like that, it might mean. So anyway, the point is, he's created this veil that separates the Holy of Holies from the people of God who are not allowed to go in there. And yet, they're given the Holy of Holies so that they will know that God is dwelling among them. It is exactly what they're experiencing in the covenant that God made with Abraham, which they know they have. They know they are his possession, and yet they never realize it fully. They can't enter into the perfection that he has laid out for them. They're constantly frustrated by it. This veil before the Holy of Holies is a thick barrier to testify of the barrier that exists between this world, not just Israel, but this world and God's holiness. And remember, God's holiness is the testimony of his blessing on this world. Be holy because I am holy, he says throughout the law in Leviticus 19, for instance. When he's saying that, he's not just saying, and replicate me and I'm done with it. He's saying, be holy because I am holy, and in that holiness, in your obedience to me, which he is entailed in his holiness, when you are obedient to me, then you will experience the full blessings that I have for you. And so in every evidence of their lack of the blessings of God, their famines, the disease, the death, the frustration, the war, everything that they experience, it itself is a testimony of the barrier between them and the holiness of God, which now this veil, this curtain, this blue veil separates them from God's holiness in that same way. Now we come to the Christmas story, right? Luke 2. We love Luke 2. We love the whole account of Luke 1 and 2 as Zechariah is told about John the Baptist's birth and receives his name from Zechariah, his father, John. Jesus is the one who's going to be blessed in the temple. And by the way, in that experience of being blessed in the temple, his own mother is going to have to contemplate the words of Simeon and Anna who prophesy over him. Jesus later studying in the temple with the great scholars who are there to talk about the theology of God and so on. All of those events that are happening in Luke 1 and 2 at the beginning of Luke, all of those events are happening in the temple. They're all centered in the temple. They all culminate in the temple, except for just these few. Mary receives Gabriel nowhere near the temple. The shepherds hear the announcement of the angels out in a field outside of Bethlehem. Jesus is actually born nowhere near the temple outside of Bethlehem, in the countryside, not in the temple. Why is that? Why is it happening that way? And believe me, as you read the stories of Luke, and I love doing narrative analysis, as you go through these stories, the narratives, one at a time, and you lay them next to each other, we are supposed to see how obviously different it is that everything else happens in the temple. And then Jesus shows up out here in the countryside, and the message of the angels shows up out here in the countryside. What's going on with that? And so as we read in Luke 2, I just want to make this point for you. As Joseph, I'm going to make the point from Luke in Luke 2. In a way, I don't even think the readers who first read Luke 2, no matter who they were, I don't think they were necessarily going to see this right off the bat. But by the time you get to the end of the book of Luke, it's unmistakable. You cannot avoid it. So if you've been putting the whole story together. So in Luke 2, the story goes this way. Joseph went up from Galilee, from the town of Nazareth, to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, begging for us to look back to the reign of David, to the successes that he had during his reign, to the establishment of God's blessings in Israel through Bethlehem. So we're looking back to Bethlehem with David. And Joseph is going to be registered with Mary, his betrothed, who was with child. And while they were there, the time came for her to give birth, and she gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger because there was no place for them in the inn. So here they are, not even in the proper place of Jerusalem, not in Bethlehem proper in the inn where other people would have been, but out in a cave somewhere where you would have fed your animals. They're giving birth to Jesus and laying him down and taking care of him. And in the same region, in verse 8, you know, as if you visit Bethlehem today, and I hope you get an opportunity to do it, if you visit Bethlehem today, you can go to a place where you stand in one spot and you look in one direction and you see the fields where Boaz met Ruth and where across the creek they would have kept the sheep on the night when the angels announced the birth of Jesus. Those are right next to each other. There are only so many places around Bethlehem where this could have happened. This is not the wildly speculating kind of stuff that you get with other locations in the New Testament as you go and visit the land of Israel today. It's, you know, it's in these fields over here. And so you're looking over there, and then you take a couple of hundred yards hike up from the place where you're looking, and here are the caves where people could have kept their animals and would have. And it's in one of these caves, and they've picked one they think it likely is, and who knows whether it's that one or not, but it's right there that Jesus is born. All of this is happening in the same place where Ruth meets Boaz as a testimony to God's faithfulness to his people, where the angels show up and bear the testimony to the shepherds, and where Jesus himself is actually born. It's all right there, which is not hard to figure out. I mean, Bethlehem's not a huge place. It's just a daughter city of Jerusalem, not this huge city, but a village. And so, of course, it's right in the same area. And What happens? So in that same region, there were shepherds right there by Bethlehem. There were shepherds out in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And an angel of the Lord appears to them. And what is it that shines around them? The glory of the Lord shines around them. And they were filled with great fear. We shouldn't be able to see this. We're not supposed to be in the presence of this. This is the response everybody has to angels, because we know they're too holy for us. Angels are in the presence of God. If we can see an angel, we will perish because we're not holy enough to see into the presence of God. And so they are with great fear. But the angel says to them, don't be afraid, fear not. For behold, I bring you good news of great joy, which shall be for all people. This is, remember, the original promise to Abraham. In your seed, all the families of the earth are going to be blessed. This is great joy that I'm bringing for all people, the angel says, because unto you is born this day in the city of David, where God demonstrated his faithfulness to his people by giving them the son David in this miraculous way, providing for Ruth and Naomi through Boaz and his field and the faithfulness of his people to keep the commandments of God. In that city of Bethlehem, in the city of David, a Savior has been born, who is Christ the Lord. And this will be a sign for you. You'll go find the baby wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger in the real world, over here in this cave where you'd feed the animals. And suddenly, there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God and saying, glory to God who is in the highest, but on earth, peace toward those with whom he is pleased. I mean, the testimony of what's happening here is really clear as we get later into the story in Luke, but I just want to bring up the possibility now of what they're seeing. Whether they interpret it this way, whether they understand it or not this way, this is what's happening. If the shepherds had gone into Jerusalem, to the temple, what could they have seen? They would not even have been allowed into the holy place where the priests went regularly so that they could take care of the showbread and the candles and keep everything going the way it was supposed to go and offer the sacrifices or keep the oil and so on. They wouldn't have seen any even of that. But let's suppose they snuck in with the priests. They got past the brazen laver. They washed and said, no, it's okay for us to be here. What would they have seen? The same thing the priest saw, and nothing more. They would have seen a blue veil with angels embroidered on it, testifying to what was inside the veil, which they were not allowed to see. Those statues, actually, of angels, gilded angels, covered with gold, wings stretching from wall to wall, hovering over the representation, the ark, hovering over the throne of God, so that they could say, he is holy, God is holy. They're not allowed to see that. They just see the curtain, the blue veil with the embroidered angels, who are a testimony to what's going on inside the curtain. But even inside the curtain, it's just the temple. It's not heaven itself. And so those statues of the angels are a testimony to the true angels, who are so remote, so hidden, that no one, not even the high priest once a year when he went in and saw the statues and the imagery representing the holiness of God, not even that high priest would see actually into what Isaiah does not see in his body, but in a vision when he is talking about the death of his king, but he sees the Lord high and lifted up and then is anointed to go out with the message to the people of God. No one gets to go into the Holy of Holies in God's heaven. It's too sacred. And so barrier after barrier would have stood between the shepherds and the holy place of God if they had tried, even if they had tried to go into the temple to see it. But out in a field, simply tending their sheep, looking up at the blue veil of the sky itself, embroidered with the stars of heaven, inviting our glimpse into eternity, inviting us to look beyond the heavens to their Creator, to God. As the shepherds look up at that sky, God tears open the veil, and the angels themselves speak through it to the shepherds. The glory of God itself pours into the world, shining light from him. It says the glory of God shined around them and they were filled with fear. They are seeing what they thought men couldn't see. God has opened the heavens so that they can see into this holy place, so that the holy place itself can come out to them. Because what's happening in that moment? Not just, hey, the veil is torn and now heaven is pouring out into the earth. The veil is torn and heaven is pouring into the earth because the Son of God himself has left the chamber of God's holiness to step into this world as a baby born, not into the holy place in the temple, but into a manger in a cave for this world to experience God's glory in it. The Christmas story is that. That's why the light of God is coming into this world, so that as we take the final step here, we move toward the end of Luke's gospel to one episode that I want to point out, which has two meanings, but I really want to focus on the one that I think Luke has in mind when he shares it with us. In Luke's account of the gospel, when he gets to the crucifixion, after the interaction that Jesus has with the criminals, he describes this, and it's around noon when this finally happens. It was now about the sixth hour, he says, and there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour while the sun's light failed. And Luke is begging us to look back to the beginning of the gospel when Jesus came into the world, and even before Jesus with the prophet John the Baptist, who's coming into the world to lead the way for Jesus. In Zechariah's prophecy about John the Baptist, he says, so that the sunrise shall visit us from on high to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace. Zechariah is saying that about Jesus, that John the Baptist is going to lead the way for the sunrise to visit us from on high. So that Jesus coming into the world in the book of Luke is this sunrise, this light shining into the world that's been given to us. And so when he says there was great darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour while the sun's light failed, it is this perfect image of the light of Christ in this world being snuffed out in his death. And yet the meaning of that is about to be turned ironically and powerfully to exactly the opposite of what they think is happening. The disciples are going to be terrified by this. Oh, no, the darkness has returned to the world. We'll hide. We won't have any hope for the future. That's what they're going to think. But the reality of what's happening is what comes in the image of the next half of that verse. This is in Luke 23, verse 45 right now. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Now, I know that we are used to reading this to simply mean what the author of Hebrews uses it for, which is accurate. There's nothing wrong with this part of the meaning, that God has made a way for us to enter into his holiest place so that when we have needs, we can ask for help from him. We love that truth, and it's a beautiful truth that he's given us. But the truth that Luke is portraying is the opposite. Not that the curtain of the temple has now been torn in two so that we can ascend into the holy place of the temple and find the holiness of God, but the whole theme of Luke's gospel and then the book of Acts, which Luke writes afterwards, the whole theme of that set is to say that God's holiness is no longer contained in the chamber of the holiest place of the temple. The temple's veil has been torn in two, and now the holiness of God that was presumed in image to be kept in that chamber is pouring out into the world because in Christ's death, he is overcoming the power of darkness and death itself. And as the disciples are going to say later to Jesus, well, is the kingdom going to come now? He says, well, that's in the Father's hands, but I'll tell you what's in your hands. Right now, the Holy Spirit is going to come on you, and you will be witnesses of my resurrection, is what he's talking about. You will be witnesses of my lordship. You will be witnesses of my presence in Judea, in Jerusalem, in Judea and Samaria, and the uttermost parts of the earth, all the families of the earth. It was always pointing in this direction to say that God's holiness is now invading the world in front of us, so that God's glory and holiness is now being released into the entire world. And the testimony about that that follows is the centurion. As Jesus, you know, ascends into heaven, as he says, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit, and then breathes his last, the centurion's testimony is that certainly this man was innocent. We know in other gospels, certainly this is the Son of God. It's the declaration of the acknowledgement that Jesus was right. His light is now shining in a different way. The crowds deal with it by returning home and beating their breasts, and the women who are with Jesus are standing at a distance, watching these things, contemplating the same way Mary did after the testimony of Simeon and Anna in the temple when Jesus was dedicated, when he was circumcised and dedicated at the beginning of the gospel. In all of those stories we're being told, including in the fact that Jesus is born in the countryside, that God's glory is not contained in a location anymore, but has now been released into the world. God has entered the world made by him. And he has proven he is still Lord, not only by Jesus coming into the world to be born, but through his resurrection. That's what we have to deal with. As believers, we acknowledge that. We follow him. But the entire world has to deal with this reality that God has come into his world and revealed his glory in the resurrection of his own Son. There is nowhere he is not Lord. There is, therefore, nowhere he does not go, and nowhere we are not sent. So, as we go, and hopefully we remember this all through this Christmas season, as we go with his Spirit, may the whole earth be filled with his glory and goodness.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.